Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. Well, not only are we going to be talking about mind power, but how about a little bit of time travel? We're going to be going backwards in time, and this I think you're going to find a bit intriguing, because Frank Joseph is a man who absolutely adores doing research. The unique and the unusual intrigues him, and he one time was the editor-in-chief of Ancient American Magazine, and he's done a lot of books on Atlantis and prehistoric America civilizations that used to be here. Now, his book, Before Atlantis, I thought, Before Atlantis. Well, of course there was something before Atlantis. I wonder what he could possibly be addressing in this. Oh, my goodness, I was fascinated with the material. Because we're going to be going back in our time machine 20 million years of human culture and what he likes to describe as pre-human culture. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Donna. Thanks so much for inviting me back, and I look forward to our conversation today.
Well, Frank, there is so much about Atlantis, and I find it so intriguing that people get stuck in what I call historical time clocks, and they just stay there because they don't know how to go backwards. Actually, sometimes they even have a tough time going forward. But we're intrigued with all of these new discoveries that we're making archaeologically that truthfully is throwing a lot of history that has been mandated by ancestors, if you will, that say, this is the way it was. And I go, that's not the way it was. There were different things going on. And that's what your book, I find, addresses. Now, first, how could you determine that you could go back 20 million years? Let's ask that question, because that's a number any one of us has a hard time even wrapping our minds around. 20 million?
Right. That's asking the reader to make quite a jump, I understand. But I agree with you. I think that the textbook version of the past that we've been given is limited, and is only a very small part of a far broader drama that included human origins that go further back than we've been led to believe. We are told that the very earliest beginnings of human types started about 2 million years ago. Unfortunately for that particular paradigm or point of view, a number of artifacts have emerged really over the past 100 years that completely contravene that idea that that humanity's earliest roots go back about 2 million years ago. What I'm referring to specifically are a number of discoveries that were made by leading archaeologists of the time. These were not fringe theorists. These were university-trained professionals. I'm referring especially to the Armigo brothers. Juan Armigo, back around 1910, was the first to excavate human tools. They were very similar to the stone tools that are associated with tool making in Europe, and as it was adapted here in the Americas as well. And these stone tools were really not too different than Stone Age utensils. The trouble was that the site for these tools that was found by Juan Armigo dated back to 20 million years ago. He knew that because he applied the same criteria for examining the past in stratigraphy, in other words, different layers that were laid down geologically. Mm-hmm. And the same geological layers that are accepted by paleontologists going back 20 million years ago, these stone tools were found. Now, people thought, well, perhaps they somehow filtered down into this particular strata. No one doubted that these stone tools were found within a 20-million-year-old strata. But people thought, well, they must have got there because they filtered down. That was immediately ruled out because the top layers were totally undisturbed. Now, if that was the only evidence of not only human beings in existence 20 million years ago, but actually making tools, these were relatively modern human beings making tools 20 million years ago, if that was the only such evidence, we figure, well, this is an anomaly which somehow will be explained by something else, some other natural cause. But as it turns out, also in South America, in Atlantic coastal South America, other sites were found which were almost as old. And now sites like that are being found around the world that go back literally many millions of years before the first human being supposedly evolved in East Africa about 2 million years ago. So we are led to some very disturbing conclusions about the origins of mankind, which I've tried to tackle in my book Before Atlantis, and some of these questions hopefully we can talk about today.
Well, I just love finding information that talks about sites all over the world that are so similar to each other. I have just thoroughly enjoyed the fact that the pyramids in Egypt have not just been in Egypt, but they've been in South America. They've discovered them in China. You know, they're here in the United States. And to me, it just shows that this globe we live on has gone through many, many, many shifts and changes, whether it has been from environmental alterations, weather. But you brought in something that was quite an interesting twist, and I would like for you to share the information on it because it's about a volcanic eruption. And I know my husband and I often in conversations with people, even today, we say there's so much volcanic activity that's going on. All you'd have to do is have a super duper Krakatoa and you're going to find that weather is altered, you're going to find there could be cracks in the Earth's crust. I mean, there's just so many things that can happen. What happened that literally decimated the population on the planet? I mean, that was really a phenomenal and very interesting item.
It is, and I'm glad for the opportunity to discuss that. There is a volcano, the remains of one, in Indonesia. It's referred to as Mount Toba. It is the largest volcanic crater on Earth. And our scientists have known for some time that this was a major eruption. However, it wasn't until really the end of the last century that Earth sciences developed to the point where they could really date this volcano, when it exploded, the magnitude of the volcano, and its effect on the Earth. As it turns out, to make a long story short, Mount Toba exploded 75,000 years ago, and the eruption of this volcano is the largest known volcano that has ever exploded on planet Earth. And it so altered the environment that it wiped out whole species. And I'm not talking about the immediate environment of Indonesia or Southeast Asia. The entire planet, the entire biosphere, the whole atmosphere was altered by this incredible amount of ash that was erupted into the atmosphere. Now, what's interesting about that is that until that time, until 75,000 years ago, humanity, we now know, human beings numbered about 2 million. That was world population. This is known through DNA studies. Now, the human beings that were around at that time were not all modern human beings. They didn't all look like you and me. There was Homo sapiens, but there were also other human types that were sort of caught in a kind of an evolutionary merry-go-round. And even the Homo sapiens at that time had really not developed very much, hadn't evolved except very slowly, and had not really achieved too much as a species. But after Mount Toba exploded, the human population of 2 million worldwide was reduced to about 1,000 to 2,000 breeding pairs. In other words, our population was, human species was pushed to the brink of extinction. And the survivors of this incredible natural catastrophe had to be the toughest, physically the strongest, had to be the most intelligent and the most adaptive members of our species. And they survived barely because of their wits and their strength. And that was really the best thing that ever happened to mankind, because you and I are a direct product of the immunity systems that developed as a consequence of Mount Toba and all of the adaptive abilities that humans are so renowned for stemmed directly from that natural catastrophe that wiped out all of the other lesser versions of humanity. And tracing that back, this is now known, this is accepted, this is actually mainstream, almost mainstream science. When this information first started to come out in the 1990s, some scientists had their misgivings about it. Others did more of their homework, and they found additional evidence that confirmed that, yes, Mount Toba did explode to this incredible magnitude, and we do know that human beings were reduced to maybe about anywhere between about 5 and 20,000 survivors out of 2 million. But the people that evolved after that became what we are today, modern man. And looking back at that now, I found additional evidence, which I'm able to set forth in the book, that shows that civilization really emerged not too long after this, that the human beings that survived Mount Toba were of a higher type, and they made the transition from savagery to civilization, I believe. And the earliest traces now of civilization do not begin only about 5,000 years ago, as we're told in our schools and in our textbooks in the Near East. I believe that civilization had a very important impact there in the Near East, in Mesopotamia, between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. But the earliest indications of an organized society really begin in Indonesia, not too far from where Mount Toba began. And this early civilization, I believe, spread around the world. It was not only the first civilization, but it became a global civilization. And we're seeing earmarks of that as separated as Easter Island in the Pacific and as far away as Turkey. And the evidence for that is mostly in the statues that are found. On Easter Island, I think most of our listeners are aware of the great statues that are famous for Easter Island. They're called Moai. And these statues are very unusual because they're all basically the same type of human figure. And the orientation is towards the navel. These are standing stone statues, some of them as high as 40 feet. And their hands cup their bellies, and their fingers go right on their navels, and there's a prominence given to the belly button stone. Well, this is part of the name, the original name of Easter Island. Easter Island got its modern name from a Dutch captain who discovered Easter Island in 1722 on Easter Sunday, but its original name was Te Pito Te Henua in the Polynesian dialect of that area. Te Pito Te Henua means the navel of the world. And it seems to be dramatized by these statues with their hands oriented towards their navel. Now, on the other side of the world, in Turkey, there is a new archaeological site. It was only found about 15 or 20 years ago, called Göbekli Tepe. And Göbekli Tepe is the oldest known human habitation site of its kind, with stone monuments. And it goes back to about 11,000 years ago. And there you see the same type of statuary, unique statuary, in which there are these stone figures, human figures, in which these long tapering fingers are oriented again towards the navel. Göbekli Tepe, interestingly enough, in Turkish means the navel hill. So some idea may have been passed down through generations without even knowing or suspecting this strange sight that was discovered, like say, only about 20 years ago. So we're seeing these commonalities in various parts of the world that indicate civilization began in the southwestern Pacific, beginning about 75,000 years ago.
I think that when you start rolling those numbers off your tongue, people again go, 75,000 years ago. I had someone say, what difference does it make? Why is this important? What in the world does this mean to us in present-day life? They were obviously so separate from us. And I think that one of the myths that is being dispelled is that these were civilized people. On the statues on Easter Island, someone, after all of these many years, after their having been discovered, finally decided to dig down to the base of the statues, and they find that there's actual language on the statue there, and these people had left books of a type. Those few that survived, nobody knew how to read, but they had their own language. So there was a level of sophistication. They weren't just a bunch of barbarians on this island acting like a bunch of monkeys. That wasn't what was there. We don't have enough information because there's been so many thousands of years that have passed, and we really, you know, just don't know. And I think the question, again, I would ask you is, why is this valid? Why is this important? Someone listening to this today may say, who gives a hoot that people were around 75,000 years ago? What counts is today? How would you talk to them? What would you say to that person?
I'd say, look at the events that just happened in Boston. How could that possibly have to do with Easter Island and the deep past? Americans are confused why such a thing happened, why people would be driven to such an extreme to create such a horrific event. And people ask that question only because they betray a complete absence of history, total ignorance of history. They're unable to put together different causes that eventuate into the types of incidents that we have there. People that have no sense of the past, no sense of history, blunder forward from one disaster into another. It's the same thing as if you could somehow remove from someone all knowledge of their past, all their experience, all their training, everything, remove it all from them and leave them with only enough information of what happened in their lives about 2 weeks ago. Such a person would be rendered incompetent, lost, confused, dazed, and completely unrooted in their own time. That's what's happened to America. We have Americans don't like history. They're not interested in history. They're completely cut off from it. And as a consequence, they don't know what's happening to them. And they're continuing to stray from one catastrophe into another and will continue to until they're able to see how things link up. The more one understands the past, the more one has a deeper feeling of the past, the more one is rooted in the present, and the more you're able to see what could happen in the future and how you can avoid things in the future. So history is probably the most important subject that people need to understand, and is the subject which is most avoided today. And the consequences are obvious. Now, these civilizations in the past, we talk about them not only because they achieved great things and because they're part of our human legacy, but because these civilizations aren't around anymore, are they? What happened? Did they have something to do with their own demise, or was it a natural catastrophe, or did they just get old and fade away? Now, especially if these civilizations made mistakes, and the leaders and the people, the inhabitants of these cultures, although they rose to great economic power and military influence, and were around for a long time, something happened to prevent them continuing on into our day. Does that mean that our civilization also is finite? Or are we just going to go on forever, unlike...
Hello, it sounds like we lost our guest, Frank Joseph. So I know Doug is going to call him and try to get him back. Excuse me? Thank you. Doug is going to try to... Something happened to Frank's phone line, and it totally dropped. One of the components in the book, Before Atlantis, that I find very intriguing, it has to do with DNA. And he's got a chapter called The Red Paint People. And as soon as we get him back online, then we're going to be talking about this. Now, the reason this intrigues me so much is that DNA, because of our technology and our ability to be able to find out about a person's heritage, is becoming very, very significant. I think it's wonderful, because so many times we have assumptions about our heritage without really understanding the genetics that are going on behind it. How is it that you have a youngster, and I'll use my family for example, I had a brother. My brother was tall and lean and was about 6 foot, 6 foot 2, and always had a problem. He wasn't a very supple person. Wonderful. Frank, I'm sorry that your phone line dropped, but regardless, what I was talking about, I wanted to move forward and talk about the red paint people, because I am really intrigued with DNA. And in today's world, and this is what I was saying to my audience before you came on, we now are able to do testing to find out who's linked with what. And we are becoming even more sophisticated with it, and we're able to go back in a genetic stockpile, finding out that maybe someone that may appear to be African-American really might have a substantial amount of European blood in them, and maybe they had a Nordic ancestor. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing. Tell us about this red paint people. I had never heard of them before I read your book, and you have a picture in here of Demas Duet, who was a full-blood Beothuk Native American, and you say it's the last known living descendant of New England's red paint people. She's lovely.
She's a very, very nice-looking lady. Well, the reason you've never heard anything about the red paint people is because they're not discussed in our schools, they're not written about in our textbooks, because they're kind of embarrassing to professors who continue to teach us that Columbus was the first person to discover America, that he's the discoverer of the New World in 1492. Well, the red paint people are known to have existed up and down the eastern seaboard of the United States. They've been known up for over 100 years. This is not news, but it's news that has been suppressed or neglected to death, and you have to dig it out. That's why I was glad to write about it in a book of this kind. The red paint people suddenly appeared about 7,000 years ago. It's a long time ago. About 7,000 years ago. In other words, we're talking about the end of the last ice age, couple hundred years after the end of the last ice age.
Right.
They appeared on the eastern seaboard, and they began to erect these stone structures. They were known to have built these, what they are called middens. Middens are like garbage heaps that contain whale bones and other remains of deep water fishing. So we know that these people were traveling by sea. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, these people known as the red paint people were called that because they used a certain ochre, an iron oxide, they would spread on the bodies of the deceased members of their tribe. And they buried them under these stone cairns and spread this red paint on this sort of red ochre. Well, studies have now shown that this is exactly the same type of burial that was conducted in Norway and Denmark about the same time, about 5 to 6 to 7,000 years ago. and that the DNA tests now that are being conducted on the remains of the Beothuk, this is a tribe which no longer exists, also shows DNA traces back to Western Europe. And the drawing that was made of this lovely lady, that's the last survivor of the Beothuk, indicates that she is not a typical Native American by any stretch of the imagination. She could pass for a Northern European. So what I'm talking about in this book is that the red paint people are an indication of one of the numerous peoples that arrived on the shores of North America, not hundreds, but thousands of years before Columbus was even born. And we're not talking about castaways, people that just survived some storm at sea and that happened to be blown on the eastern seaboard of North America. Instead, these were people who made regular colonializing ventures to North America, that established themselves here, went back and forth between Labrador and Newfoundland to Northern Europe, Denmark and Norway, parts of Scandinavia, and that our heritage as Americans does not go back only to 1492, that our heritage goes back centuries and millennia. You don't have to go to Stonehenge in Britain or the Great Pyramid in Egypt to find ancient materials, ancient monuments and great monuments that are found also here. And that's basically what Before Atlantis is trying to emphasize, is that America's heritage is far richer and deeper than we ever suspected.
Yes, in fact, in your book, you talk about dolmen, that's D-O-L-M-E-N, and this is just, there's so much in the United States that we are discovering that has been here for so long. We have begun to discover that there are so many people that have lived here. We're not talking about just a handful of tribes. We're talking about a tremendous amount of population that, well, they had their trade routes here in the United States, and they were all over the place. It's really amazing what we are beginning to understand and what we're beginning to see here in what was considered a newer nation. But really, this has been populated by people from different areas of the globe for tens, thousands, maybe millions of years. And I wonder how we are going to deal with the changing of the history books, because so much of what is taught no longer applies. It's not true. An exaggeration. Frank Joseph, your book Before Atlantis brings so much information out. You have the chapter on the first Atlantean. You have some wonderful photographs in here. You go into Stone Age deja vu. You go into after Atlantis. And, of course, I like your quote by Cicero, to be ignorant of the past is to remain a child. That joins full circle with what you were saying a short time ago. How can people find out more about your research and what you've discovered? What's your website, Frank?
They can reach me at www.ancientamerican.com. That's the magazine that I still work for. And I've taken a lot of the material for Atlantis from the past issues of this wonderful magazine that we launched back in 1993. And Ancient American discusses things that you don't find in the textbooks, and it talks about, it reports mostly on contacts from overseas that made a very important contribution to America long before Columbus.
Well, I agree. 20 million years ago? Well, quartzite tools, that's right. Where? Argentina. So we are finding out so many things. If you have a curious mind and you want to say, well, I may not believe this stuff, but I wonder, check out this book, Before Atlantis. I think you'll find it extremely interesting, especially with the backup data. Frank Joseph, thank you for being my guest. Have a magnificent day, and let me know when you come out with your next book.
I certainly will, Donna. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
You're more than welcome. Have a wonderful day. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away. More good things to share.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone line, if you'd like to call in and chat with me today, is toll-free, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I would be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, so just give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. For those of you up in the far north, the state of Alaska, I'll be up in Alaska on the 29th. Of this month, and I'll be on a business trip there through May the 6th. I'll be in Fairbanks and Anchorage, and if you'd like to meet with me while I'm up there, give me a buzz at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604. I understand that this has been one of their coldest winters that they've had in a long while, but it's warming up. Yes, it's actually warming up, but it's still brisk when it's 20 degrees at night. Donna Sebo here, 888-627-6008. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with Ray Arata. Now, Ray has taken upon himself a project of talking to men about themselves. Ah, yes. Women, well, we've been doing that with each other for a long time. But it's not always easy for men to be able to communicate effectively and well about some of their concerns and some of the things that they know they need to change. Well, he's put out a book called Wake Up, Man Up, Step Up. That's right. That's what he's got. So that's what we're going to be talking about tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, we're going to be talking about food, glorious food. Hello, taste, goodbye, guilt. Howard Rosenthal is going to be my guest. Reincarnation is going to be the topic of conversation on Thursday, to be continued by Karen Berg. And then Catherine Ravenwood is going to be my guest on Friday. How to create sacred water. Water, the gold of life. I have been saying that for a long time. I jokingly say whenever it rains here in the Pacific Northwest, which is more frequently than not, it is liquid gold. Why? Because we need it. We have to have it. If we don't have it, we can't survive. Real gold, you can't eat it. It's heavy to carry. Water is life-giving. So we're going to be talking about that wonderful substance. That and more will be coming up on the show, and I invite you to tell your friends, and won't you join us, because I know there will be things that you learn that you never knew about before. We were talking about the past, taking the time machine back 20 million years or so. Well, let's move forward into the future a little bit. What about a flying submarine? Ah, yes. For those of us who enjoy science fiction, how many movies have been made about mobile items going through the air, over the water? This is something that has been seen and visioned by I don't know how many people for how many years. And this is something, I've got a photo of a vehicle. It's absolutely huge, 500 feet long, and it is going to use a lot less fuel. How do I know about this? Well, it's because of a publication that came to my attention, and inside the publication is this information on this flying submarine. Now, what it reminds me of is a silver catfish. You know, if you look at a catfish, forget the whiskers, but just look at that rounded shape when you're looking head-on at a catfish, and it's got this form. Well, that's exactly what this looks like to me. And where the catfish's mouth would be, there is this seam. Now, what I'm looking at in this transportation vehicle, it's all encased in a silver-like skin coating. Now, this is being developed. It really has already been developed. It's in a hangar in Tustin, California. That's right. They're training pilots to fly this Aeroscraft prototype. It's 260 feet long. It's an airship built by the Montebello, California-based Worldwide Aeros Corporation. They are doing this test, and if it's successful, these 500-foot-long vehicles will be able to carry 66 tons of cargo, and that's equivalent to three times the maximum allowable payload of a C-130J Hercules transport plane. But they'll use a third less in fuel. Now, of course, the military is always interested in stuff like this. This vehicle can fly up to 140 miles an hour. It can take off and land vertically without a runway. Now stop and think of that. Without a runway. And it can go well over 4,000 miles on a tank of fuel. And it could deliver supplies to just about anywhere on any kind of terrain. Now, they call it a flying submarine because they can reduce buoyancy by compressing the helium in their tanks and sucking in air to act as ballast. The buoyancy can be increased by increasing helium, which displaces the air. Now, they've already done float tests inside of the hangar. That's how big the hangar is. It's absolutely massive. And they're going to try to do their first test flight this summer. Well, we had airships before and during the beginning of World War II until they blew up. But it's something that we're going to be going after again, but in a different way. Wouldn't that be amazing to see these silver things flowing in the sky? Yes. What we might have been seeing as a UFO somewhere on this planet could well have been maybe a prototype of something like this. Donna Siebel here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. That's 627-6008. John Galesworthy of the Foresight Sagas said, there are moments when nature reveals the passion hidden beneath the careless calm of her ordinary moods. Violent spring flashing white on almond blossoms through the purple clouds. Ooh, I could relate to that. When I saw this poem, if you will, or description of blossoms on a tree, it reminds me of our neighborhood. We have cherry blossom trees that are just blooming like you wouldn't believe. They're white or pink, and they are just prolifically blessed with all of this abundance of flowers. And these are trees that have these wonderful arching branches that sometimes reach out over the streets. They're just absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous to see. Take time to enjoy the beauty of this time of the year. It is just, I know here in the Pacific Northwest, it's breathtakingly wonderful. It's rejuvenating if you feel stressed and you just are overwhelmed by things. Get out, take a walk, shift your thinking, look at the beauty that's around you, and just be appreciative of this wonderful experience that we call life, because it is yours to enjoy. I wanted to share some little bit of trivia with you, and this is just a couple of points here. One is that which we call paper today that we use so abundantly that comes from trees. Before that was used, vellum, which is a very fine quality writing parchment, came from animal skin. People used the resources that they had, and in many parts of the world, there were more animals than there were items like papyrus or things of that nature where they could make paper from it. They especially liked it from the lambs, the goat kids, and the very young calves. Now, the coarser leathers used to be made from the skins of male goats and older calves. Vellum replaced papyrus and then was superseded by paper. And that's why so many times we cannot find items that maybe were written centuries ago, because if they were put on papyrus or were put on other things that could deteriorate with time and age, and vellum can deteriorate too, but it has a greater stamina to it. But can you imagine maybe 500 years from now, people coming across an archaeological discovery maybe a million years from now going, what is this stuff that these people use? Called paper, I think that's what they call it. Who knows? It's always good to speculate a little bit. Many times when it comes to health issues, we like to put things in a box. We like to see, and this happens over and over and over and over again, we put labels on conditions we might have without really knowing what's going on. To me, the human vehicle, actually life itself, is absolutely fascinating. But the human body has so many variables to it, and real strange things can happen. There's a museum in England that has abnormalities that they have been able to pickle and preserve, things that are not typical in with most people. Well, there was a Dr. Kenneth Iverson, who is a professor emeritus of emergency medicine at the University of Arizona. And a 9-year-old boy was brought into his emergency department, and he was having very, very severe abdominal pains. And the parents said, well, you know, he gets these abdominal pains and then they go away. But when they hit, he just doubled up and screamed. He had been examined over and over and over again. Couldn't figure out what it was. They put him on a special diet. They did x-rays. They couldn't figure out what it was. Well, what happened is that this doctor did something a little bit differently. He examined the 9-year-old boy, and he leaned back against a big red resuscitation cart. And he said, I did something that's not a typical physician's, especially an emergency physician's, behavior. He said, I closed my eyes, and I just relaxed about what was in front of me, because this child was going through a lot of pain. And he said he started going through his file cabinet, his mental file cabinet, very quietly. And he went through all kinds of probabilities, possibilities, and finally he said, we need a CAT scan right now. Now, 45 minutes later, that's how quickly they'd gotten him in. In fact, he had bumped other patients to get this boy in. 45 minutes later, they got an emergency call from the radiologist. The kid had severe malrotation of his intestines. Now, what is that? It means that all of the tubing that is normally held in place by your ligaments and tissues was just free-floating. So it could move and twist. Now, this twisting was causing an obstruction of blood flow to this 9-year-old boy's intestines, and that's what was causing his pain. This was critical. This was a real emergency situation, because if the blood flow is obstructed for too long, part of the intestines would actually die, and that would be fatal to this boy. So they had a pediatric surgeon that was on call. They went straight to the operating room, tacked everything down, That's right. They had to tack it down, and that cured the problem. Amazing stuff. Without that CAT scan, that touch of modern technology, they couldn't tell from an examination that this intestinal area was twisting and turning. They had no way of knowing because there were times he didn't have pain. So I think technology brings a lot of blessings with it that, well, if we use them correctly, can save a person's life. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break. If you want to give me a buzz, call me at 888-627-6008. We'll be right back.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny. They will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone number to call into if you'd like to chat is 888-627-6008. Well, you all know, having listened to this show, that I am Italian background. One of the things that I grew up with was an antipasto. Now, an antipasto, typically in my home when we were growing up, you had salami, you had garbanzo beans, it was always vegetables, it was a salad. And, of course, many of the ingredients, you had different types of olives, you had sardines. There was no limit to your antipasto. And fish, you could have tuna fish, you could have whatever you liked. But it was something that was meant to munch on with bread. You actually could make a full meal out of it, but it always was so beautiful to me. And someone came up with this real speedy thing that you could put together using bocconcini, which is the little mozzarella balls, and you can use mushrooms, and you want to have perhaps some kind of a dressing. But I found that so many ingredients that I could put in, like your artichokes and oil, you're just not limited with a good antipasto. And, of course, what goes well with a good antipasto is a double cheese garlic bread. And I thought I would share this recipe with you because in a Sebo household, we love to take sometimes loaves of garlic bread and to slice it. I like the round loaves, and I'll make maybe like four real thick slices out of a nice round loaf of sourdough. And then butter lavishly one side. And if it's already been baked, that's wonderful. But if you get the bread where it has not been baked, you have to bake it yourself. It just gives it a nice crust. You slice it and then put the butter on it. And then you take like a cup of grated Fontina cheese and a third of a cup of shredded pecorino cheese, Romano cheese of some kind. And then you're going to need 2 teaspoons of garlic powder, a half a teaspoon of dried basil, quarter of a teaspoon of pepper, your bread, your crusty bread sliced, and your parsley. And your oven, if you want to make the crusty bread, I like to use a broiler. I like my bread so that it's sort of soft, crusty on the top with the cheese, but I like the rest of the bread soft. If you want to bake it, you can do that too. you can put your oven at 450 degrees, and putting your bread on a baking sheet that's lined with foil is always a good idea, because if the cheese boils over, then it's easy to clean up. And you take your cheeses, and you can try this with other cheeses, by the way. You can use the Fontina, the Romano cheeses, garlic powder, basil, and pepper. You just mix that together. That takes you all of 30 seconds. And then cut side up, brush your piece. You can use olive oil instead of butter. My family likes butter, but you can use olive oil instead. And you just spread the cheese mixture over that, bake it until the cheese is melted and the bread is toasted. It's going to take about 10 minutes. Put a little bit of parsley, fresh parsley on top of it. Looks beautiful. Cut it into pieces. Yum. Good stuff. Cheese bread. Oh, this is great. But you can try different cheeses with this also. And you may find that you have particular preferences. I really like stronger flavored cheeses. I like a good, strong flavored Parmesan and just something that's going to really make everything blend. And with a good antipasto, remember, if you're going to make an antipasto, you can just have a nice big platter, use flavorful vegetables. And like I said, the garbanzo beans, you can use different beans, you can use sliced tomatoes, you can have baked garlic in there if you want to do that. But whatever, your salamis, it's great. And with the cheese bread, you can't go wrong. You really can't go wrong. Well, I wanted to share with you just some fun things just quickly, because I know we're just about out of time, and I hope you'll join me tomorrow, because we're going to be talking about guy stuff. That's right. And ladies, it's something worth listening to, because this is from a man's perspective, and I think it's important. Sometimes we need to know what the guys are really, really thinking, or why they think the way that they do. It's really good. But I wanted to share how sometimes thoughtfulness really makes a difference, and it's often unexpected. And there was this woman who was living in an apartment complex, and she said she uses a laundry machine. We've all had this at one time or another where we've lived in apartments and we've had to use their machines. So you get your stuff in there, you get it out, because you know other people are going to want to use the machines, and that's what she was always very conscious of. Well, this one day, she got so involved with chores in her apartment, she lost track of time, and she forgot to get the laundry she put in the dryer hours ago. She quickly runs down to the laundry room, noticed all the dryers down there were running, and she said, I figured I was just going to have this pile of stuff somebody took out and just put it up on a machine. But do you know what she found? One of her neighbors had taken the stuff out of the machine and was very nicely folding everything. And she said, wow, that is unbelievable. They ended up having a conversation. She found a new friend. These things happen, and I think sometimes that we can do things for people that are just very thoughtful, very nice. Doesn't mean you do it all the time, but think, is this something I'd appreciate someone doing for me? And when you have that kind of an attitude and you just do something nice, not only does it make you feel good where you go into that zone of warmth and, I'm glad I did that attitude, but it is a lesson for someone else. It is something that makes them feel good about their life. And I think so often today in our world, we become so isolated that thoughtfulness, good manners, kindness, we think, well, it's not so important, but it is more than ever before. There are so many things that go on in life that are not pleasant, where people are really stinking. And when we reverse that, when we demonstrate the best of who we are, the best of what we have to offer. Wow. That's a good example for kids, and it shows other people that there really is that wonderful essence in life, the human spirit, that makes a tremendous difference. This is Donna Sebo. I know that we're out of time. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Have a magnificent day. Talk with you tomorrow. Same time, same place, right here on BBS Radio. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.